In the field of AI for public good, which is where we are at the UN and also in my new role in state government, it's about steering AI development toward uses that will ultimately improve the lives of human beings instead of pursuing other goals, which is, you know, power or financial concentration.
Today's episode of Multilateralism Unpacked sits at the intersection of one of the most powerful technological shifts of our time and the institutions designed to safeguard our collective future. Artificial intelligence is no longer a distant policy issue. It is reshaping information environments, influencing conflict dynamics, transforming labor markets, and accelerating both opportunities and risks for sustainable development. For the United Nations, an institution tasked with maintaining peace and security, protecting human rights, and advancing global development, AI presents both a profound challenge and a strategic test. It also poses a critical question. How can multilateral governance keep pace with a technology that is evolving at unprecedented speed? I'm Jack Dorrell, Head of Communications at UNUCPR, and my guest today is Eleanor Fournier-Toombs, who has been working at the forefront of this question. Her research at UNUCPR has explored a range of issues, from global AI governance architecture to AI-driven disinformation, gender and inclusion in AI policy, and how AI can be leveraged for human and planetary well-being. Across these areas, her work has focused on one core issue: how to ensure AI serves a public interest rather than deepening instability or inequality. Now, as Eleanor transitions from multilateral research into a senior public leadership role as New York State's chief AI officer, I asked her to reflect on her work at UNUCPR, in particular, how AI is challenging the UN system, what role the UN should play in governing AI, how that role is evolving, and where future risks and opportunities are emerging. Eleanor, welcome.
Thank you, Jack. It's a pleasure to be here today.
So you've been researching AI governance from inside the United Nations in recent years, and now you're stepping into a senior public sector AI role with the state of New York. Before we get into specifics, how do you describe this moment in the relationship between AI and the governance of this rapidly evolving technology?
I think it's a very important time for AI governance. We've seen the evolution of ethics and safety in AI over the last decade or so. And before the deployment and popularity of generative AI, there was a lot of work done by practitioners in data science and predictive analytics. And I worked on that a lot when I was at OCHA, for example, on ensuring that models were safe, especially when it came to bias, inclusion, and privacy protection. But when OpenAI launched ChatGPT in late 2022, I think that really moved the conversation front and center in the minds of everyone, and including policymakers and at a global level. And to me, that's because AI moves from being a tool that was just used for experts, still a little bit obscure, in the hands of computer scientists and software engineers, and into the hands of everyone. And so it was adopted very quickly. And with the beginning of the generative AI era, there came an acceleration of conversations about really AGI, you know, artificial generalized intelligence. Could we develop tools that can mimic human intellect and even maybe have emotional capabilities, autonomy, learning abilities? So it really changed the conversation. And I think it's been shaking up society for the last few years. And governments and international organizations have really been trying to lean in and try to figure out the balance between adoption and safety. And in the field of AI for public good, which is where we are at the UN and also in my new role in state government, it's about steering AI development toward uses that will ultimately improve the lives of human beings instead of pursuing other goals, which is, you know, power or financial concentration.
So AI is clearly developing faster than intergovernmental processes. In your opinion, I mean, what makes AI particularly difficult for the multilateral system to grapple with compared to earlier global issues and risks?
Well, there's several issues. I think many countries, especially the big powers, consider AI as a national asset. And so they're not really interested in adopting any kind of framework in international law that would, we perceive that restricting their ability to govern the technology themselves. And we already see very different approaches in AI governance at the national or the regional level, namely from the EU, which adopted a strict regulatory perspective, which requires the certification of high-risk AI deployments before they're released to the public. And the US has focused on setting national standards from the beginning, and they're continuing to do this now through the NIST AI Risk Management Framework, which is kind of deployed across the United States, and they are interested in having that deployed globally. And that addresses specific harms, harms to the individual, harms to organizations, and societal harms. It has similarities in approach to what the EU is doing, but the way in which it's implemented is completely different. And in addition to the kind of broader standards that the US is adopting, then they are going and addressing specific harms with policies if they need that. So, for example, harms to children or specifically bias in AI used for hiring. And so they address some of these harms kind of one at a time instead of having what you could call an umbrella approach for monitoring all AI tools if they're in certain kind of risk categories. So that's a challenge because the member states have different viewpoints when it comes to AI governance. And I think the second issue is that AI is so new that not all UN member states have the capacity to engage in global policy discussions from an expertise perspective. So I often joke, and it's a little bit sad, but it's true, I think, that a lot of the early speeches on global AI governance were actually written by AI, in that policymakers didn't have the subject matter expertise. So they were just using generative AI tools to help write their speeches. And so early days, you had a lot of these kinds of same speeches that were actually written by ChatGPT. And I think it contributed to the direction of policymaking, which is a little bit crazy. But I mean, it's changing now. I think more diplomats are gaining AI literacy for sure. There's a lot of trainings happening, but there's still inequality. So there's some member states that have a lot of capacity and they were able to even bring in diplomats that have technology policy expertise at a really high level. And then other member states have less staff and they have less capacity. So they kind of lag behind in terms of addressing AI policy or advocating for issues on the global stage that matter to them. So that kind of means that over this past few years, there's been a lot of reliance on multi-stakeholder advice. And large AI companies on the one end have really pushed certain kinds of values and ways of approaching this, whereas civil society organizations might have different perspectives or represent certain constituents where they want their rights to be heard and their perspectives to be heard. And so there's been a lot of kind of push and pull in terms of different interest groups in terms of how the UN should approach AI.
So I'd like to look at some of the specific risks that the AI poses to the United Nations, which your research has helped to identify. Your work on AI-driven disinformation in conflict settings, for instance, shows how information environments are becoming part of the conflict landscape. So how does AI change the way the UN has to think about peace building and conflict prevention?
Yeah, so we did a whole stream of work with Eduardo Albrecht and Rebecca Brubaker, and we produced a policy brief and a report for Interpeace, which looked into these issues in a lot of depth. And generally, I think our team really looked at the issue of disinformation. And we found that, you know, disinformation has existed as long as there's been information dissemination. So it's not just because of the internet. There's disinformation from, you know, word of mouth, print, radio, all different modes of communication. You'll always have this issue of disinformation. I think what's changed now is the scale and the reach that disinformation campaigns can have. If you combine social media algorithms, which of course we've had for the last two decades, combine those with new generative AI tools, the scale is really a lot more. And so there's different ways in which AI contributes to the dissemination of disinformation. The first is through social media algorithms. So they use a type of AI called recommendation systems, which I think people are largely quite familiar with, which kind of controls in a way a lot of our interactions online, whether it's social media, it's, you know, media content, even advertising and so on. And the recommendation systems in and of themselves have been shown to prioritize polarizing content and are also quite difficult to moderate. And then the second one is through generative AI, which can now be used to create any kind of content, right? So you no longer need an internet cafe full of people. You know, there used to be these internet cafes where people were hired to send and post disinformation content online, and they would all be posting at the same time. You don't need to do that. You know, in the last 3 years, all you need is one person to write a prompt, and you can have millions of posts that are written, you know, very interestingly with internet-connected hashtags and so on. And these can flood social media. These can be sent to influencers. We've seen that influencers are sometimes bought. They receive money to spread disinformation, and so there's a whole network that can happen. And the UN's done social media monitoring. There's an office called Global Pulse at the UN's secretariat that have done this for, I think, over a decade. But I don't think at the moment the organization has the capacity to monitor and address the changes in the disinformation landscape because it's happened so quickly and it has very nuanced effects on conflict. So I think it's actually very difficult to address this kind of disinformation because some of the content, the facts themselves are fabricated. But other times it's a combination of true and false, and it's about influence or about progressively shaping the ideas of social media users that can eventually lead to more violence. And so it's a little bit more subtle. And the UN's also been faced with disinformation in relation to its own peacekeeping operations. So accusing the UN and having maybe image, like doctored images, showing it doing certain things that are actually not the case. And so that has made it more difficult for them to conduct their operations on the ground. So the Department of Global Communications at the UN, which is led by Melissa Fleming, have done a lot of research and convening on this topic. But I think because of the complexity and the speed at which it is moving, we need even more work on it to try to get a handle on it.
Let's shift to economic development and growth. You know, reflecting on the research that you've done at CPR, do you think that AI is more likely at this moment to narrow global inequalities or widen them? And why do you think that matters for the UN's development mandate?
So I always say to this that we cannot know because we're not passive observers when it comes to AI. So there's competing interests. And the question is, you know, how are they going? What's going to be the interplay of these interests? Some developers and deployers of AI are for public good and they aim to reduce inequality, but some are for power concentration, surveillance, you know, resource growth, and so on. And so if the UN wants to contribute to AI for the reduction of global inequalities, there's a couple of avenues. We wrote about them in our AI for Good flagship report in partnership with ITU, which was just published in Davos in January of this year. And we called them the pathways for AI for human and planetary benefits. So there's five pathways that we identified. One of them is focusing on data quality, access, and government. So making sure that data is well collected, is representative, and so on. Developing digital infrastructure and ensuring access. So a lot of countries, they feel like they're falling behind in AI, and this could lead to inequality between countries. Or if there's people inside a country that don't have access to AI tools, that could be beneficial. That's where this idea of increasing digital infrastructure and broadening access would be important. We have the question, of course, of investing in AI literacy and talent. So that's always very important. We've seen a lot of brain drains when it comes to AI. So countries could invest in really good, you know, graduate programs in computer science and AI only to see that talent leave to go to countries where they could have a higher salary or more opportunities. So it's not just the AI literacy, but it's also thinking about talent retention inside a country, which is really important. And then, of course, we have the question of emphasizing responsible AI policies. So every country also needs to think about how to make sure that these tools are deployed for public benefit and that they're safe. And more generally, the fifth pathway is developing a digital ecosystem. And so an ecosystem really represents a space where the different stakeholders in AI development can together build out AI for public good. So it's having a space for startups, venture capital, civil society, academia, kind of all working together to deploy AI that works for that country. And I think that is one of the ways in which we could really reduce global inequality. But it has to be a strategic and a cohesive approach. So I don't think it's a kind of thing that would just happen by itself. but it's certainly possible. And I've seen it become a focus of AI governance at the global level, at the UN. And it also is here in my work at the state level in New York.
And your research has also considered the global governance of AI. So you've written widely about the building blocks of a global AI architecture, whether ethical, legal, or technical. Where does the UN have real comparative advantage in shaping those building blocks of a global AI architecture?
So the UN's advantage really is in its global perspective because of that's the coverage of its member states. It's really the global international organizations. And when the Secretary General created the AI advisory body in 2023, it included 38 experts that were representative of all regions of the world. It was gender balanced and from different categories of stakeholders. So the private sector, government, civil society, and academia. But what this means is that the UN can be a convener and provide solutions that can apply to all human beings. So this kind of global perspective. And it's the only international organization that can really do that. So what is done over the last few years is establish three pillars of global AI governance. The first is the International Scientific Panel on AI, which aims at creating a yearly global consensus on the risks and opportunities of AI. And so that will become a very important foundation for any legislative development in member states. The second is the Global Dialogues on AI, which will also be an important forum for exchanging ideas in AI governance. And I think the global reach is important because it's good to know what the impact is on different countries and different use cases and different perspectives. And so always having a kind of open dialogue and sharing best practices, sharing major risks is really important. And the third pillar is the international standards on AI, which have been led by the standard setting bodies, ITU, IEEE, and ISO, which allow for technical safety mechanisms to be put in place for any AI deployment. So the UN can do a lot. I mean, it can't do everything when it comes to AI governance, but it can certainly do a lot.
One tension that you've highlighted is between global coherence and national context, and you touched on that earlier in our conversation. How can the UN support countries with very different capacities to assess and govern AI risks?
So even countries with less AI capacity have a seat at the table at the UN. So it's not, I don't think there's a separation between the member states and the UN. The smaller countries are also part of the UN. And so I think they also need to assess where they want to engage with the international community and where they would best benefit. I think it's really important for smaller countries to take a proactive approach and evaluate where they want to be with this and look at some strategies such as the ones that we list in the ITU report to see what's possible and what is important for them and their residents. Once that self-assessment is done, then I think they can turn to the international community and say, we would like funding, technical support, and so on. And in turn, the member states of the UN, which they are part of, have shown a lot of interest in developing a fund for AI capacity building. There are also many education initiatives, kind of capacity building in that way, talent development, and there's all kinds of other projects. But I think the only way this is going to have a really lasting impact is if there's a national strategy behind it to support it, not just thinking of countries that are smaller as recipients of whatever is provided. Otherwise, that's where you have projects that end and when funds run out and the impact on the country might not be long-term.
I'd also just like to look at how the UN's approach to AI has evolved since you've been working in this space. And again, I mean, you've touched on this previously in our conversation, but from your perspective, I mean, what do you think has shifted in terms of the UN's ambition, seriousness, or understanding of AI?
Yeah, so there were several early indicators of the UN working in AI governance even before 2023. I would say the most important one was the UNESCO recommendations on the ethics of AI, which was published in 2021 and was adopted by all UNESCO member states. In order to do that, they worked for about 2 years. So they were working on it already in 2019. And ITU also did significant work in the domain. Ended up developing over 100 standards on AI for use in different kinds of contexts. But really, we started to see AI become a part of the UN Secretariat's key priorities after the G7 meeting in Japan in May 2023, where the G7 leaders agreed on the Hiroshima principles and called for the global governance of AI. So after that, the AI advisory body, which I mentioned, was created, and AI governance became one of the five objectives of the Global Digital Compact, which is an instrument which brings together key priorities for member states when it comes to all things digital. And so what the UN is doing now in terms of the International Scientific Panel on AI and the global dialogues, that was commitments that were in the Global Digital Compact. And so now the Office of Digital and Emerging Technologies, ODET, has taken the lead in implementing the commitments in the DDC, and work in this domain is very much of a priority. So it's very much matured and evolved over the last few years. And, you know, I don't think that the UN can impact everything that happens when it comes to AI, but I do think that if it successfully serves as a global forum where issues of global concern around AI are discussed and solutions are found, whether it's human rights, sustainable development, conflict, humanitarian aid, and more, I think this will be a really important contribution to AI for good.
So if we look ahead 5 to 10 years, where do you see the most serious AI-related risks emerging, whether institutionally or societally, that the UN should already be preparing for?
I think the UN is focusing a lot on societal risks, as it should, right? So it has a mandate already to think about the impact of AI on its pillars, you know, on human rights and humanitarian aid and so on. And I definitely think that it needs to think more about this issue of tension when it comes to governance and the current erosion of trust of people when it comes to AI. There is definitely a sense and an idea among many people that they're kind of the recipients, like passive recipients of AI technologies, and they don't necessarily have a say in the way in which they're being developed. And I really think that it's possible to turn it around, but there needs to be more effort in thinking, how do we do AI for public good? How do we make sure that AI really benefits people? And what are the areas in which we shouldn't be deploying AI tools? And I think it's going so fast, it's feeling like a bit a wave for people. And people are starting to be extremely concerned about very basic human needs. If you look at kind of a hierarchy of needs, people are worried about shelter. Are they going to lose their house? Are they going to lose their job? You know, is their society in which they live, is it going to change? And how is it going to change? And so not only answering these kinds of questions, but trying to figure out what can be really addressed and including citizens, human beings in the discussions in terms of where we want to take AI and what values should be embedded in these AI tools, I think is really important. And as we see kind of big companies gain a lot of prominence and power in this domain, we need to continue to say, you know, it's important to set a direction for where AI wants to go. And so that for me is the biggest risk. And I think that the UN as a convening body can really do a lot for that. But it really needs to take it seriously and continue to invest in that domain.
I want to finish by discussing a recent report that you wrote in collaboration with the International Telecommunication Union, Unlocking AI's Potential to Serve Humanity, which was launched last week in Davos. You referred to the report earlier in our conversation. I want to discuss the report because it makes some really compelling arguments about the immense positive potential of AI on education, climate change adaptation, health, development, and a host of other areas. I think it's fair to say, understandably perhaps, that in global discourse, the positives are often overshadowed by the very real risks that AI poses, whether it be misinformation, job losses, bias, or widening inequality. I think the focus on the positives is therefore really important, but the report emphasizes that the benefits of AI are not automatic. And you mentioned earlier the five pathways required to leverage any positives associated with AI. You didn't touch on capacity, though, which is something that you've also spoken about previously. Could you explain why capacity is important?
So, you know, this question is around UN, a governmental organization. Member states are also governments. And the need that they have to build expertise in government in AI is really strong. There's a lot of policies that are being developed, and they are requiring audits, and they're requiring pre-deployment certification, and they're requiring reporting back to citizens and transparency, being transparent about AI tools that are being deployed for human beings, for constituents in different countries. And so in order to be able to do that, I think it's really important for any member state to think about their own workforce and how important having strong AI experts, whether from the technical expertise, but also from the policy and governance side, is going to be to support that. For me, that's a very big priority because we sometimes talk about this tension between AI innovation and AI governance in the sense that some people think that too much governance or too many rules and regulations could stifle innovation and ultimately mean that people can't benefit from AI. But the other perspective, which I tend to share, is that you can't actually benefit from innovations in AI if it's not safe. But that kind of switch between regulation that's restrictive and safety that enables the actual deployment of AI happens only if the policies that are developed and the vehicles and mechanisms for approval and for checks and for standardizations are done in a very thoughtful way by experts. And so whether it's the EU with its really kind of broad AI act or, you know, any member state that has policies or standards that need to be followed, they need to make sure that they have this staff to support it, that they have experts that understand the use cases and that they're putting out things that are actually useful and positive for their own constituents. So that's what I would say if I was a government, it would be my number one priority.
Eleanor, thank you for your insights and good luck in your new role.
Thank you so much.
Today's discussion examined how AI is reshaping global governance, affecting peace and security, human rights, and sustainable development, and why the UN is becoming an increasingly important forum for norms, coordination, and evidence-based guidance. For more on UNUCPR's research on AI, visit unu.edu/CPR. Thanks for listening and join us next time.